Hi again, everyone, and welcome back to The Longest Night. We are a Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon show on the Podbreed Network. My name is Rob, and I have seen every single episode of Game of Thrones at least half a dozen times, and I have read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin.
My name is Lizzie. I've also seen every single episode of Game of Thrones, but I haven't read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin.
And my name's Jay. I've seen every single episode of Game of Thrones. I have read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin, and I've also read all five books in the Song of Ice and Fire series.
If you want to, you can find us over on Twitter. We are at LongestNightGOT. That is at LongestNightGOT. And our title music was written and provided by friend of the podcast, Edward Thomas. You can find all of his available work in the description. Jay, you've returned. You have come back
to us
from the land of much ado about nothing. How was it?
Well, it was fantastic. It was a bit strange, though, because about 15... Well, between half an hour and 15 minutes before it started, that was when the news that Queen Elizabeth had passed dropped. So we went into the screening having just heard that, and they were actually showing like a slideshow of pictures like of her life, which was very, very surreal.
God, they assembled that quickly.
Yeah,
I know, right? I have no idea. But yeah, no, the play was fantastic. But I'm glad to be back this week to talk about more Hot D.
Yes. All right then, yeah, let's do just that. This week we are going to be discussing Season 1, Episode 4 of House of the Dragon, entitled King of the Narrow Sea. It was written by Ira Parker and directed by Claire Kilner. It was first broadcast on the 11th of September 2022 to an audience of an unspecified size once again, because HBO won't release the raw data, goddammit. I don't know why they're not doing it, but apparently viewership is up, so good for them. I may have to start just reporting the linear cable figures, as they're now calling it, because now so many people aren't watching it live, they're just watching it on a streaming service later. Mm-hmm. But like this week it had the return of the NFL to contend with, so I imagine like a lot of people were watching it on HBO Max, like, you know, dad's downstairs watching NFL, kids are upstairs watching House of the Dragon, like, you know, that sort of thing. But just release the figures, goddammit, and then make everything a lot easier. never mind. Lizzie, what do we make of Season 1, Episode 4, King of the Narrow Sea?
I think this might be the best episode so far, but it's definitely one of the bleakest, if not the bleakest. That might depend on how you look at the premiere. But yeah, I think this episode puts the spotlight on Rhaenyra and Alicent in particular, and it does a really good job of conveying their circumstances as incredibly different but also incredibly similar. Like, you come away from it feeling upset and angry and even disgusted at what they have to go through just to survive in a world of uncaring men with unlimited power.
Yeah, it's funny how many words you said there that are in my notes in just a slightly different order.
Really?
Which is good. I think that if the people involved with the creation of this episode were ever listening to this, I think they'd be happy that their themes and intentions had come across to at least two of us anyway.
Yeah.
Jay, you weren't here last week, but we read your brief thoughts out about episode 3, but you can speak your thoughts aloud now. So episode 4, how was it for you?
I mean, you know what, if it keeps on going like this, I'm going to be a happy boy, because it's been a really good show so far. Yeah, I really liked it. I don't know whether, I think I said that, you know, third one might have been my favourite. I don't know whether this tops it, but it was just as enjoyable. I really liked it. I think, I responded really well to, I think that, you know, the big theme for me that I got out of it was, like, bluntly, is sex and, like, how this world views it and the different people within it view it. And attitudes to it, but also consequences of it and how those consequences differ between people of different kind of different places and different sexes, and yeah, it contains, as you said, like a few very, very disturbing sequences, which on paper, like, might not, you know, if you were to read them, you might not think you'd come away from that feeling so uncomfortable, but the way they were shot, the way it was handled, like, really drove the point home. Yeah, I thought it was really, really good.
Yeah, I'm feeling similar to you two, where I think it's probably joint for me with last week's episode in terms of being my favourite so far. I feel like I've, just with this episode though, I feel like I've really come to understand what the show is now in terms of how it's forming its own path away from Game of Thrones. There are big differences between the two shows already that I'm beginning to see form now after this episode, and it's curious, I think, and I am curious to see how it develops these differences as we go along. It's kind of like, if Game of Thrones is Breaking Bad, then House of the Dragon definitely feels like Better Call Saul. I'll explain that a little bit more as we go on. I think it's an episode, like you said, Lizzie, that focuses right in on the respective differences between Rhaenyra and Alicent that have formed based on the experiences that we've witnessed so far, and that those differences are contrasted during some really absorbing sequences and conversations. And I think the central kind of question about those two, which is, like, they're both in their own way first ladies of the realm, and it's like, what first lady of the realm would they be? And I also think this episode allows Emma's comment about the differences between male and female battlefields, it just kind of hangs over the episode again and echoes out across the episode. And I think, I kind of think it's about dark secrets as well. There's lots of emphasis on lies and disguises and spying and dark passageways and actual rats in the Red Keep and things like that. And yeah, it's just interesting to watch it operate now. I feel like I've gotten comfortable with this show very quickly. The pressure's kind of come off. I think, you know, when you watch the first couple of episodes, you're sort of thinking, like, well, you know, is it going to be as good as Game of Thrones? How's it going to be the same? How's it going to be different? You know, you get a bit preoccupied with it. Whereas that third episode last week, I think that's been a good point to settle down. And by extension, now that it feels a bit more settled and comfortable with itself, which I always felt like it was going to get to, I always felt like it was going to be, now it feels very much like its own show that's kind of forming its own identity. And it means that without that preoccupation of, oh, how's it going to compare to Game of Thrones, it's much, much easier to watch and a lot of fun as well.
Protection? The princess has a dragon, you dumb cunt.
Dragon!
I'm glad to like that one. Let us have the next. So we may go to supper.
Craven.
We're leaving.
She that steal, you twat!
Send word to the harbour and have Captain Oswin ready the ship.
Princess, would you end Bitterbridge in 3 days' time?
I would happily row myself back to King's Landing if I brought an end to this ridiculous pageant.
Don't look, Princess.
Right, part one of the episode. Okay. At Storm's End, Princess Rhaenyra is continuing her tour of the realm to hold audiences with potential suitors for her hand in marriage. Soon enough, a fight breaks out between two boys, resulting in the older boy being killed, or at least severely injured. Sir Criston escorts Rhaenyra out of the castle and back to their ship, and they return to King's Landing 2 months earlier than planned. So it's just a short opening sequence this week. Lizzie, what kind of notes did you take during the stuff at Storm's End?
I will say that for such a bleak episode, it's got maybe the best comedy moment of the entire series so far. As, like, I love Rhaenyra's flabbergasted, and now a child, followed by, Willem Blackwood?
Yeah.
Killing Gerald Bracken as Rhaenyra walks away. I just kind of wish, because, you know, they cut back to it. I wish, I don't know, have you both seen the day-to-day?
Yes.
Bits and pieces, so, but yeah.
there's a bit in, like, they're doing a political segment and, you know, it cuts to an interview outside the House of Parliament. And in the background, you see one of the reporters, Peter O'Hanrahan, walking with some woman. And they just have a discussion. Then they both stop. And then the woman just sort of hits him in the face and he falls to the floor unconscious. And he's just there for the rest of the segment. I kind of wish they'd done that, where it's like they're walking away and in the background... the other guy just happens to get killed and that's it. That's the end of scene. But yeah, really, really funny stuff. I'm glad they put this at the beginning, because I feel like it would have been a bit tonally off if it had been anywhere else.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally agree with the placement in this episode. Jay, when the episode opened up and I realised we were at Storm's End, I did think about the conversations that we were going to have regarding Storm's End, because it's nice to actually see Storm's End.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not like a mark against Game of Thrones, but, you know, we never saw Storm's End in Game of Thrones. And on this occasion, I think it's a bit of a shame that we didn't get to see it from the outside, but without spoiling too much, we are going to go back to Storm's End at some point, either later this season or really early next season, and so we'll probably see it from the outside then. But it was good how, like, they made it feel, well, very stormy and very windy. Like, you could just tell the weather outside was just like, oh god, I wouldn't want to be stood out in that.
Yeah,
but that opening sequence, Jay, how do you feel being at Storm's End?
Well, I think that's something that I'm seeing in every episode so far, is a lot of... It's foreshadowing, but it's not just foreshadowing, it's establishing, right? You know, we've talked about how, you know, when Game of Thrones starts, you're kind of globetrotting, you're kind of you're everywhere, whereas we're quite restricted in this show at the moment. But I think it's, and I kind of expect it to do it more, it's establishing locations that we're going to go back to later. It's like reminding people, no, there is a world out there and we're going to come back to it. So I like that we're seeing Storm's End, and so that when we come back to it, you know where you are and you know what's happening. I have two notes for this opening bit. The first one's a joke and the second one's more serious. The first one just says, in all caps, Blackwood and Bracken, yay. because I love the rivalry between the Blackwoods and the Brackens. And as soon as I saw a Blackwood on screen, I nudged Emily and was like, oh my god, a Bracken's going to come on screen now as well. And then they did, and they started fighting. Because that rivalry is just hysterical to me. I absolutely love it. But I thought on a more serious note, and I don't know whether it's intentional, but it's what I got from it. Because you have the comedy of the old guy trying to woo Rhaenyra, and it's funny, and clearly she's been there for ages and she's sick of it, and it's played for laughs. But I did get a really strong sense of tragedy from having this, like, you know what, 11, 12-year-old, like, being thrust into this, like, horrible environment where he's got to pretend that he wants to be off it. And it to me, it was kind of like a glimpse into how we've seen a lot about how the women of Westeros are indoctrinated into kind of the horrible system that they have. And that to me was like a glimpse into how men are being indoctrinated into it. Like, you're being thrown in front of someone at a really young age and told, no, you have to be married off. You have to try and then he gets into a fight, and it's kind of horrible.
No, I think that you've picked up on something there that I picked up on too, which is, like, first of all, that actor's line readings were excellent, because it was done in a way that you could kind of, like, Lena Velaryon a couple of weeks ago, where you could tell, like, the reading is slightly stilted, but it's
rehearsed.
But it's purposely rehearsed and quite stilted. Yeah. And I love that little touch. But yeah, this is a really good example of where Emma's quote about male and female battlefields starts to hang over the episode, where Rhaenyra must endure the charade of hosting potential matches, and then one of those potential male matches engages in a sword fight that winds up with someone dying over basically nothing.
And
so again, it's about how, you know, males are socialized into men who must fight and must protect, and how women are socialized into sort of, like, I don't know, I'll have you, or, you know. And then if, say, Rhaenyra and this kid were going to get married, then it's like, oh, you know, there'll be some song about how, like, he bravely defended her from a foe on his, you know, the first time they ever met, and like it was, you know, that their eyes met across the room and stuff like that. And it's good how you can get a load of good material out of such a short scene. I think it's an example of the episode's big strengths so far.
Absolutely, yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
No. I will not revisit this debate. You were always Mother's favourite.
No, it's no great mystery.
You were. Our mother, she had no regard for custom or tradition, rules. And I, sadly, was no great warrior.
Congratulations on your victory.
Thank you, Princess.
Perhaps Prince Damon would care for a tour of the gallery. He hasn't yet seen the new tapestries gifted to you by Norvus and Cawhor. Oh,
would you like to see the tapestry? He has no interest in such things.
I'd like to see them.
Oh, well, then you should not deprive yourself.
Rhaenyra and Kristen's return to King's Landing coincides with Daemon Targaryen's return to the capital. He announces to Viserys that he was named King of the Narrow Sea after his defeat of the Crab Feeder, but surrenders his crown to Viserys and states that the Stepstones are now the property of the crown. Viserys then hosts a welcoming party for Daemon, and the brothers catch up. During the party, Alicent works out that the tour didn't exactly go well for Rhaenyra, and Rhaenyra explains that she doesn't want to be made to sit in a castle and squeeze out heirs. The comment offends Alicent, and Rhaenyra apologises. Shortly afterwards, Rhaenyra reveals to Daemon that she's worried she will suffer the same fate as her mother if she ends up married. And at a small council meeting, it is revealed that Corlys Velaryon has entered an alliance with the Sea Lord of Braavos. Lionel Strong argues that Corlys still holds a grudge against the crown from when Viserys chose to marry Alicent over Laena. So, a few scenes there. So, we'll start in the throne room. Lizzie, I don't know if you have any comments about Daemon's triumphant return.
Yeah, there is. This is where the dread starts to creep in, when Viserys kind of warmly welcomes him back. It's like, dude, do you not remember last time he was here? Do you not remember what this guy's like? And obviously you see the consequences of that by the end of the episode.
Mm.
It's just, it kind of speaks to Viserys's weakness, his inability to be assertive and not accept his behaviour.
Yeah, I mean, it is just that, you know, we talked about how Viserys is clearly supposed to be, he's presented as soft. He's too soft on his brother, but he also knows how soft he's being. And I got the strong sense in this of, like, he spent a significant amount of time almost kind of lamenting the fact that he's kind of lost touch with his brother, and now he's just relieved. But there is that sense of, like, of trepidation of, like, okay, well, but what happens next? I was looking forward to the scene because I've always liked, there's a, in Fire and Blood, like, this scene is depicted like with an illustration, and I always thought the illustration was quite striking of him like handing the crown
offering the crown up
to his brother.
Yeah.
So I really liked the way it looked. I liked the way it was staged. But it is just that thing of like, okay, but how long is this going to last? Because it isn't going to last very long. And as we see as we go through the episode, like, I think Viserys is kind of at the end of his tether now. He's kind of deteriorating. Quite literally as well.
Mm.
And so all of these kind of relationships that he's having are potentially going to start chipping away. And you just have to think, okay, but what's Daemon in this for? Like, what's his game?
Yeah, it's another event. They've moved up a bit that really benefits the story of the show. Because this happens a few years before Emma dies.
Yeah.
But they've moved it up to afterwards. And it really does. I think a lot of the adaptive decisions they've made have really benefited the story so far. And like Daemon's return to King's Landing, offering up his crown, and like you, Jay, it's a really striking illustration in the book. And it's one of the few scenes, actually, it's one of the few passages in Fire and Blood that's like, you know, that gets right down into like the details of the moment. And it feels like whatever historical record is being written here, it feels like a pretty good and accurate one. But it's just, again, like you two have noticed, it's just that dynamic that Daemon has in this show, where you're never quite sure if he wants the throne or not, or whether he just enjoys the security of being a Targaryen, or whether he wants just to be seen to be liked and wants to be popular with people.
Or he enjoys fucking with Viserys.
Or yes, or if he just enjoys messing around, or if he's playing a long game or something like that.
He's
Yeah, I love how unpredictable he is. I mean, obviously, he's as things progress in this episode, he's not a particularly likable... Well, he's not a particularly nice person, but I think he's incredibly likable as a presence on screen, because I think in the first couple of episodes, I think what House of the Dragon maybe lacked was a character who was a bit unpredictable, who was a bit, you know, a bit of a maverick on screen and didn't behave the same way that everybody else behaved. And I think already the characters feel stronger by episode 3 and episode 4. Their individual identities within this small story. They're not just actors wearing blonde wigs now, which I couldn't understand why people felt that way a little bit in the first couple of episodes, but by now they all feel very different to one another. They've all been fleshed out quite nicely over the course of about 3 or 4 episodes. The next scene, the party in the garden, this little gathering that they have. I've loved this this video that's gone round. Unfortunately, it was posted by somebody on Twitter and then nicked by a much bigger account. So I'm just gonna find the video, the original tweet from Kathleen Hanley, Kathleen_Hanley on Twitter, where Alison says, "Perhaps you should show Daemon the tapestries," and it's just the video is just these two guys laughing and high fiving while they slowly fall to the floor.
Like hyenas, yeah.
Oh, that's great. It's such a sad scene, because like whenever Rhaenyra or Alison try to get any kind of word in, it's just, whatever. Let me talk to Daemon for a bit. And Daemon has no interest in such things.
Yeah, and it's another one of those things that's all speaking to the theme of like, they're back together, so they're all pally and having jokes and stuff. Meanwhile, like, the mother of your children is just kind of having to go along, and your daughter, who you're having to, you know, try and marry off, they're having to kind of figure out their own stuff while you're having a party, and it's all kind of like, you're seeing the divisions grow in real time in a scene like this.
Yeah, and it's like, oh gee, I wonder why Daemon thinks he can get away with all of this stuff. It's because you treat him just like, I don't know, like your baby brother. I guess. Just while on the subject of tweets, I wanted to point one out here from Liv Kate Cooks, who says, "Viserys laughing at Alicent for offering to show Daemon her new tapestries when he has a gigantic Lego set in his bedroom."
That's such a good point.
Yeah.
Speaking of Rhaenyra and Alicent trying to sort out their own shit, when they're sat on that bench, I don't know if either of you have taken anything about the sort of unfortunate conversation they end up having.
It is just kind of one of those, you know, as soon as she says the line that of, I forget the exact wording, but it's like, you know, I don't want to be married off and just be made to squeeze out babies all day. It's kind of like, oh god, that's got a sting, because
there's literally only one person that could be aimed at. It's like,
yeah, exactly, right? And also, yeah, it's just, for me, the thing that stuck out the most about this little conversation, it's a really small thing, and I don't even know if I can necessarily describe why I like it so much, but when she says that, immediately afterwards, she looks and realizes that she's like upset her, and she says sorry. But it's the most quiet, like, whispered, like, sorry. And I don't know why I liked that so much. It seemed so sincere and so, like, I really, really wish I hadn't just hurt my friend. Because they're kind of in that relationship, in that conversation, they're kind of building up a friendship again. They end it by holding hands. And I don't know, that really tiny sorry just really got me.
Yeah, me too, because Rhaenyra's really headstrong and is determined not to be trapped by her sex, but has clearly not noticed that Alicent has been groomed and trapped in the way that Rhaenyra absolutely doesn't want to be. And Rhaenyra is so headstrong and is so determined to not be stuck in a position like Alicent. So she's kind of forgotten that Alicent didn't really have a say. Like, I know this is kind of a bit of context that's, I think, maybe missing from the show that could have been a bit valuable, but basically, but I guess it couldn't really happen in the show, could it? Because they've aged Alicent down. But in the in the books, Alicent is also a servant to Jaehaerys right before the end, because the the previous king, Jaehaerys, he dies while Alicent is reading to him as he goes to bed, I think. And so she bathes and dresses him and stuff, and she gets to know him, and then like then it she becomes a similar confidant for Viserys, whereas obviously in the show, if she was looking after Jaehaerys, she would have been like 6 years old when he was dying. So like, they've messed around with the timelines a little bit there. But the conversation on the bench really emphasizes again the great decision that they've made to make them the same age, because it means that they're growing up at the same time but having vastly different experiences.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can see them more clearly. And speaking of vastly different experiences...
But would she make a powerful queen? Or would she be feeble?
Feeble!
For Aegon the Babe Prince might long for a claim. He has two things Rhaenyra cannot. A conqueror's name and a cock.
Lies! Slander!
Yeah, just if you will. But many of the small folk are like to believe that as a male, Aegon should be the heir.
Mm. Their wants are of no consequence.
They're of great consequence if you expect to rule them one day.
For one night, I wish to be free of the burdens of my inheritance.
Rhaenyra returns to her chambers to find clothes and a map have been left for her. She changes into the clothes, which disguise her as a common boy, and follows the map to Daemon. Daemon leads her through the city at night, and the pair see a show, during which Rhaenyra finds out that the common people don't quite support her claim to the Iron Throne. Daemon then escorts Rhaenyra to a brothel, where the two of them start to kiss, but then Daemon suddenly backs down, for a few reasons, leaving Rhaenyra alone in the brothel. As Rhaenyra makes her way back to the castle, she is recognised by a spy. Meanwhile, inside the Red Keep, Alicent bathes King Viserys before bed. The pair then have sex, but Alicent simply endures the experience and pretends to Viserys that she's enjoying herself. Returning to her chambers a second time, Rhaenyra entices Sir Criston Cole into her bedroom. She attempts to seduce him, but Sir Criston is initially reluctant. However, they soon undress themselves, and the pair of them have sex. This is by far my favourite bit of the show so far, which says a lot because of how much I enjoyed The Hunt last week. Lizzie, take the there's a lot to get through here, but take the lead on it.
Yeah, I think I'm with you there, Rob. I guess I'll get to the less bleak stuff first. I really love the exploration of King's Landing's darker corners, you know, the nightlife, which I don't think we ever really saw that on Game of Thrones, because obviously you see it from the side of the royals, and they're kind of, they spend most of the time just holed up in their, you know, grand palaces. And yeah, also really happy to see the acting troupe make another appearance. like, combined with Rhaenyra's transformation into a common boy, felt very much like a nod back to two different stages of Arya's story, when she was concealed by Yoren as Arry early on, and later witnessing a similar retelling of recent history by the acting troupe when she was no one, which I thought was a really nice touch. And also, I love Rhaenyra's lies, slander. Boo. Yeah, I really love this segment. Like, I don't think we are going to get more of this, but yeah, I just love this little glimpse into a world that you never really see from a place that you thought you knew all about.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of occasions in Game of Thrones where you got to see at least the nightlife in King's Landing, because you do get flashes of how the common people live in King's Landing. There's a lot of stuff in season two where...
How often do you see it at night?
Yeah, exactly.
Blackwater, you know, and that's not really nightlife. That's like being holed up in the Red Keep for survival.
Yeah, pre-siege.
But
the stuff... I love how slightly surreal and psychedelic the approach was to the direction of the stuff on the Street of Silk and the Mummers Play.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like Dutch angles and slightly, I don't know, just slightly, it made me feel a little bit like, you know, the opening stretch of Moulin Rouge, but just dizzying, you know, that the camera actually stays still and focuses on things and doesn't build a whole huge set and then barely point a camera at a part of it for less than 2 seconds. Sorry, I'm not a big Baz Luhrmann person.
he doesn't know how to keep a camera still. Let's agree on that.
Yes. But yeah, the Mummers Play, and the, like, I love the slightly... You know how, like, the Mummers Play in the sixth season of Game of Thrones, it obviously wasn't like a high-budget production, but like the makeup was good... And there were actually women playing the roles as well. I think there's
Who everyone is,
yeah, and there's a little nod here to the fact that like the makeup's not that great and it's all men in drag playing the roles of the women and stuff like that, and there's just something slightly Punch and Judy, like uncomfortable psychedelic vaudeville about it. I really, really appreciated that. Also, just I won't obviously be very I won't be specific at all here. I'll try and be as vague as possible. But there, for you, Jay, I don't know if you spotted them, but there are three distinct, very heavy-handed moments of foreshadowing for events in the future during this sequence.
I mean, I saw one of them.
Yeah, there's. I'll talk about them off with you privately.
Okay.
But there's three, and I'll come back to them as the events will no doubt come up. But there were three moments where I was like, oh, like that. So just a few nods for book readers there. But I think, Jay, I don't know if you have anything about the happier side of Daemon and Rhaenyra's night on the town.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm completely with yous on the nightlife thing, and it's more of that thing of like it feels like a living, breathing world, and it's just fun to see characters just engaging with it, like in a broad sense. And yeah, the players are a lot of fun. There's also another piece of foreshadowing when they run into someone in an alleyway, which is quite fun. Very, very brief, but again, it's just one of those things of just, hey, this is a world, and there are some things in here that might come back later. But yeah, I just think it was a really, really great scene, and it's a scene of like you kind of know you're on Rhaenyra's side because you kind of want her to experience like to get out of the stuffiness and stuff. But it's got that undercurrent of, as you said, Matt Smith kind of is very clearly not quite the good guy in this episode, and he proves it by donning like a hood and like walking around like completely in shadow, which obviously he's staying unknown, it makes sense, but just visually it kind of makes him look very, very shady and untrustworthy. It was a lot of fun. And then it gets weird.
The hood's very Assassin's Creed, I thought.
Yeah, it is a little bit, isn't it?
The only other thing I wanted to say before we go to the darker stuff is that the only place I can recall seeing nightlife was Vyas Dothrak in season 6 when Jorah and Daario are trying to get Daenerys from the Dothraki temple, the temple of the Dosh Kaleen. Very brief. And it kind of reminded me of that a little bit. But yeah, everything with Daemon and Rhaenyra contrasted with Alicent and Viserys feels like that's the episode's defining sequence for me. Really love it. I love the complicated and messy dynamics of all three sex scenes that go on here. The contrast between Rhaenyra and Alicent's respective lives at this point, I think the show starting to establish what really makes it tick, and this is kind of like what I meant before, RE, Better Call Saul to Breaking Bad, where it's like the main source of drama in Game of Thrones, I thought, or like how it crafted its drama, was big moments and big payoffs after really economical setups and really good character work as well. But it was a moments show. It was a show of moments. It was one of those where, like, it was kind of like a secondary sub-economy of Game of Thrones was watching people watch it. Like, yeah. you got a lot out of seeing other people react to things that you knew were coming. And whereas with House of the Dragon, it feels like the main source of the drama is these kinds of sequences where it's not really much about the macro change, it's just about the little teeny micro character stuff that goes along underneath. Because not much actually happens here in terms of actual plot progression, but it's the implications for character that are huge. Yeah. Like, as House of the Dragon has gone on, I have not been tempted to watch the Burlington Bar videos on YouTube. Like, when, because for Game of Thrones, I thought they were really, I enjoyed them. It's not how I would like to watch Game of Thrones, but after I've watched the episode, it's good to watch, like, people treating Game of Thrones like it's some sporting event, like hooting and hollering at the TV. But I just, when I watch through House of the Dragon, it's just like, there are no moments in this show where I'm like, yeah, I want to see somebody react to that. Because I think,
yeah.
And it's kind of like that with Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, where it's like, would I want to watch somebody watch Breaking Bad to see various moments? And it's like, yeah, I would, because it derived its drama in a similar way to Game of Thrones, where it was like, it was about the macro changes on a smaller scale. You know, it was more about a drug empire in an area of America as opposed to a throne that controls a whole continent. Whereas, would I want to watch somebody reacting to Better Call Saul? No, because it doesn't trade in those kinds of sudden changes. It's like a slow, glacial, you know, careful, gradual progression. And it was something that Miles McNutt wrote about in his coverage of this episode, where he says that House of the Dragon's got a smaller story to tell, so it can prioritise thematic storytelling a bit more, and it can just move characters in small ways that reinforce those themes. And so, and I think House of the Dragon will have those moments. I think once the time jumps stop, I think there are definitely moments coming that are going to be like, you know, the touch paper hasn't quite been lit yet, in terms of what the show's actually going to cover, and so that will get lit eventually. But for now, at least in this first season, the main source of drama are the power dynamics between Rhaenyra's scenes with Daemon and her scene with Ser Criston, and the scene with Alicent and Viserys. So specifically, I think about the first sex scene in the brothel. Lizzie, like, how do you read that now that it's kind of had a chance to settle?
Well, both times I watched this, I found it very off-putting. I think combined with the shots of Alicent looking like she'd rather be anywhere else in the world than having sex with a man some 40 years her senior. Like, the prospect of sexual coercion is much more obvious with Daemon leading an unknowing Rhaenyra into the brothel and putting her in a situation where she's unable to say no or walk away. But also Viserys comes out with a particularly grim line as Alicent visibly grimaces right in front of the camera. He just sort of leans down and he says, "Marriage is a duty, yes." It's like, again, there's no way out of that situation for Alicent. It is, you know, you're stuck there. And as much as, you know, you've not necessarily been forced into it, you have been pressured into it. And that pressure is, it's not just, you know, I'm a man and you're a woman. It's like, I'm a man and I'm much more powerful than you. And I have this structural power that you will never be able to have, because that is the nature of things. And again, it's like what I said before, it's similar but different. Pressure and expectation, and no is not an option. I think what really sells it as well is the music. You know, that it's like that nauseating seasick music in the background that I'm trying to think of anything that's similar in the show, but that particular really sort of makes you queasy. It's a horrible scene. It's really well done though, and gets the message across perfectly, I think.
The way you've described it there, it kind of reminds me the bind that Alison is in. It is a bit the implication from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where it's like, you know, what am I going to do? Say no? Like, she can't.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So yeah. She's essentially trapped into consent in a way, because, you know, what's she going to do? Say no? Like, I mean,
you don't have a choice, no.
No, and I think there's also little things in this episode about how titles take away identity, because there's that little comment that Alison makes earlier in the episode where she says something about, like, you know, I'm just the queen. I'm a position rather than a person, and it's all about the duty that comes with the position and the duty that comes with being married to the king and stuff, and, like, you just got this rotting 50-odd-year-old bloke. Just like, you're just underneath him, and then, like, you have to sort of... Oh, she's back picking her cuticles again, by the way. She briefly stopped last week, but she's doing it again. And then when it's all over and she looks up, and there's... I couldn't tell on my first watch what it was she was looking at, but on the second watch, it's a rat crawling all over the bed and, like, ugh. And... Ugh. Yeah, there's a whole, you know, literal rats inside the Red Keep thing going on, and it's just a miserable, like, because I don't think Viserys is the kind of guy who would ever, you know, if Alison ever said no, not tonight, he wouldn't be angry. But there's also this sense that, like, when the maid comes in and says the king has requested your presence, there's a bit like Alison's never gonna say no, because she's not, you know, it just... It's expected of her not to do so.
That's the thing. I don't think he'd be angry, but I think he would say, "But it's our duty."
But it's your job.
Yeah, it's like, it's sort of pressure that way rather than intimidation.
Hmm. Yeah, Jay. What about you? The Rhaenyra Daemon stuff in the brothel, because I don't know if you agree, but there's a very... To me, there was a serious overtone of grooming going on here.
Definitely.
This. I don't know if you want to lead off on that, but
yeah, I mean, it's definitely there, and obviously the whole thing, regardless of, you know, when we can dig into, like, what each individual character's thinking or going through and how the dynamics are working, there is just the very obvious and in your face ick factor of, he's her uncle, and unfortunately you kind of just got to kind of go with that, because that's going to get in the way of kind of analysing it. But it is unpleasant. But yeah, completely. It's a complete sort of like, oh yeah, come off with me into the middle of the night. I can show you the wonders of King's Landing. You talk about how, Rob, you talked about how, like, the approach as they're going through the nighttime of King's Landing is kind of psychedelic. I think it carries on when they go inside the brothel, because you're kind of half seeing things, and there's, you know, there's curtains which are kind of see-through, but you're not really seeing it properly, and it's all kind of a bit wavy and a bit strange. It's properly putting you in her shoes of, like, this kind of intoxicating atmosphere of, oh god, I don't know what's happening, and do I like it? Maybe I like it, maybe I don't like it. I don't know what's kind of going on. I think it's important to remember as well something I didn't pick up on the first time, but I saw it very vividly the second time, was, I think, this idea of Rhaenyra and Daemon. It's a thread that's running through the whole episode, and I didn't even remember the first time, but the episode opens with her, you know, when she's going through the suitors, the camera is looking at her touching the necklace from Daemon.
Yeah.
And I think we're supposed to kind of keep that in our minds of, like, this is kind of horrible, but also there's something there, and whether or not it's kind of her coming to that conclusion by herself and thinking, oh, maybe I do have some kind of feeling there, or maybe it's just her desire to act up, or you know, kind of stick the finger up to her dad, or to act out, to be the complete opposite of Alicent, the complete opposite of you know, this whole thing is about duty and for the realm and all the rest of it. She just wants to do the complete opposite. Maybe it's all that kind of going on. I think, regardless of whether or not you know how you feel about it, I think the complexity is kind of the point. You're supposed to feel uncomfortable. You're supposed to feel not really sure who wants what. And as well, it throws an extra curveball in by having Damon back out and not and decide he doesn't want it at the end. Like, that's kind of an extra, like, okay, what on earth is happening? Like, what's going on in these characters'
heads? Yeah, you're left wondering again, what did he actually want out of this?
Yeah.
And
it's I really liked it. It just for how bizarre and unpleasant but ambiguous and it was really good. And yeah, the juxtaposition between the two things, it's the same juxtaposition as episode one of like, here's this thing that's kind of like action packed and like in a way like supposed to be presented as exciting and titillating, and here's this horrific thing, this horrific inversion of it, like being played at the same time.
Yeah, it's a really good link, Matt, because I was wondering last week, like, when are they going to do another montage? Because, like, the first episode really played with montage in dead interesting ways. Yeah. And I was kind of waiting for another one to come along, and this was another one that I think is another montage where I'm like, yeah, I'm into this. Like, I'm getting what you're trying to say. And yet the end of it, the full stop, at least on, it's more of like a comma or a semicolon, when Damon abandons Rhaenyra, like, at least on the surface, it seems like it's because what Damon wants is for Rhaenyra to not really enjoy the experience and for him to have complete control. But then when she turns around and is like, yeah, I'm well into this, like, is it a kink? Is it a power thing? Like, you're not quite sure. There's a lot on the table that just kind of gets left. And I really like that it just gets left and it kind of hangs over. And I love that shot where they suddenly cut to like a mid... Well, I suppose it's more like a wide shot of Rhaenyra's like full body just kind of like exposed. And she's trying to pull her clothes over herself and just sort of like protect herself because she's suddenly alone in the middle of King's Landing and her guardian for the evening has just buggered off somewhere. And it's just this sudden brutal pause point like that. And then obviously she finds her way back through the city and she gets spotted and stuff like that. But she makes her way back to her chambers. Another thing that kind of gets left unsaid in this episode, but is screened very loudly by the fact that Damon gives her the map, which is that Damon knows a secret passageway and he can just get into Rhaenyra's chambers anytime he wants. So that's something. But the Rhaenyra and Kristen scene is my favourite scene in the episode because this could have gone, and I'm going to cite an example, Bridgerton, this could have gone very badly wrong.
Yeah.
I think that this scene, I think that's, to be honest, that's, those are the best kinds of scenes actually, where they can go very badly wrong one way or another, but because they get it right, it's like there are constantly plates spinning and they just manage to keep them all spinning, and it ends up as a really rewarding experience to watch Sir Criston and Rhaenyra's scene together. Lizzie, I don't know what takeaway you have from it.
Yeah, I mean, in comparison to everything at the brothel, I think, like you, Rhaenyra's scene with Kristen, it feels like one of the few times in the show so far where she has any control over her situation. Like, again, the use of music is poignant here. It's tender but mournful. It's a reminder that this moment is fleeting and likely the last time she'll experience anything like this now that the higher-ups are watching her every move. So yeah, it's beautiful, but it's kind of heartbreaking at the same time.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because the music is something I picked up on as well, where on the surface it's kind of sweeping and romantic, and but there is that little undercurrent of darkness. There's just something going on there where it's like there's something not quite 100% right about it. Because I think, you know, the scene is shot in a way that it's tender and it's sweet and it's warm and it's, you know, it feels like for a second they do eventually get to the point where they navigate all of the strange power dynamics and consent dynamics and gender dynamics that are at play in that silent sequence where she's holding this helmet. And they get past all that, and then when they get down to it, it's, you know, on the surface it feels like a loving embrace that they have with each other, but there's just something we know. The music plays with the dramatic irony. And I think it speaks to a lot of what's actually happening in the scene as we watch what is quite pleasant on the surface. And then if you think about it, it's just, So, Jay, like, your takeaway from Rhaenyra and Sir Criston and just how, like, it was all pieced together.
Yeah, I think we're supposed to, or at least I feel like we're supposed to feel relief almost in this scene. Like, I think, you know, one aspect of the prior scene is like, oh, Rhaenyra is kind of free and she wants to explore and not be trapped like Alicent. And I feel like there's a kind of the show is kind of trying to make us breathe a sigh of relief when she comes home. So she's home and she's with the Kingsguard, so she's safe. And it's like, but in this safe environment, she's going to potentially explore some feelings and some stuff. And I feel like we're kind of supposed to think that. But then the undercurrent being, this is politically, you know, one of the worst things that you could do. Like,
yeah.
Both you and for him, because obviously he's a Kingsguard. He's not allowed to do anything like this ever. And obviously you're the princess, and that's, you're about to be married off for, you know, political reasons and alliances and stuff. That's, this isn't good. I feel like that's the undercurrent. But yeah, I got a strong sense of relief of like, okay, she's kind of exploring it in a much safer environment. And like, I can't speak to this myself personally, but watching it with my girlfriend, she turned to me afterwards and went, that was great. That was the most female-gazy thing I've ever seen in a Game of Thrones-related thing. Just like the whole like lead-up of like the taking the armor off piece by piece and stuff. And, you know, will he break the vow? Will he not? And it's kind of like, it frames, like the way it's shot seems very framed around her experience and her pleasure. I thought it was good and interesting, and it's kind of if it was going to happen on that night, I feel everyone in the audience wants it to happen there rather than somewhere in King's Landing where something even worse could have happened.
Yeah, I think it's really marvelous because, yeah, the one I don't know why, but the barometer I now set for whether a sex scene works for me or not is based on this episode of Bridgerton that I saw. Because I've watched the first season of Bridgerton. I didn't bother with the second one because I thought it was decent enough and I kind of enjoyed it mostly. And then I felt like the last episode was really good, wrapped everything up, and then they just kind of put a cliffhanger in because, hey, you know, it was successful, we need a second season, like, you know, that sort of thing. And so, but have either of you watched Bridgerton?
I haven't, no.
Yeah, I didn't really get on with it.
Yeah, how far through did you make it, Lizzie?
About 4 episodes in.
Yeah, I probably would have flagged at a similar point if I wasn't watching it with my partner at the same time, but there's a scene, I don't know if it's, I forget which episode it's actually in, but you know, Lizzie, in Bridgerton, there's the Duke, and like his whole thing is that he loves Eleanor, but he doesn't want to get married and have children because he's sworn that he will end his father's line. Like, his father was horrible to him and abusive to him as a kid.
Yeah.
And so on his deathbed, he goes to his dad and says, I'm going to end your line. That's it. That's your punishment for being so horrible to me. But obviously, Eleanor is like, well, I want to have children and I want to marry you and I love you. And so they eventually develop a sexual relationship. And then, but he always manages to orchestrate. Basically, they do a bit of family planning. And so he always orchestrates it so that, like, he won't get her pregnant. And then there's this scene where Eleanor takes charge of them having sex. And she basically, even as he's begging her to stop, she carries on and Mm. Basically traps him with her legs so that he can't move. And then, so obviously the inevitable happens and he's distraught. And then she's angry that he's distraught, which, yeah, okay, fine. That's on a character level, that makes total sense. But then we finish the scene as if we're supposed to sympathize with her for like...
What?
And it's a mess. It is a fucking mess. And
Jesus Christ.
In a scene like this where she's got Sir Criston's helmet and he's lower on the food chain than she is, and if he doesn't do what she wants, she could easily have him beheaded. She won't, but that must be a worry in his mind. And so when she teases him inside and shuts the door, it's like she's trapped him for a second. And it's just like, oh, where are they going with this? But then he's shot in a certain way so that you realise he's much bigger and much stronger than she is, and he's in full armour. So while she has the political power, he has the physical power. And so you're never quite sure who's got the upper hand. And it's potentially very messy. But then the way the scene navigates it really beautifully is by having them undress themselves. It creates a mutual understanding between them in that moment. And it shows that the team behind it have thought about every step of the way. And you can, as they pass each checkpoint, it's really, really sweetly done, and it's still difficult, and it's still that you get the sense of relief, like Jay said, that she's at least, if this is happening, it's in her bed, it's in her chambers, it's in the Red Keep. But there is just that undercurrent of this is a potentially a massive mistake for both of them. It's a moment of impulsivity and passion. And you're also wondering a little bit, like, has she learnt something from Daemon that maybe she shouldn't? But, you know, it's really, really well executed. It's potentially a scene that could have gone very wrong, done very right. And, I'm really pleased that they went down this avenue and that this happened. Because I'm not 100% sure. I don't remember this incident from the page. Because, obviously, it's something behind a closed door, as far as history is concerned.
Yeah, the relationship between the two of them is one of the things that's kind of shrouded in rumour and has different interpretations in the book.
Yeah. Because it happened behind a closed door, so as far as history is concerned, did it actually happen?
Yeah, exactly. I do, just briefly, I do quite enjoy the image, by the way, of, you know, you have like the generic shot of two people slept together and then they wake up in the morning and someone knocks on the door and they've got to frantically put their clothes on. I like the image of Sir Criston having to put on like full plate armor while Rhaenyra is like stalling at the door.
It just makes me think of that, I don't know why, that what you've said there, it makes me think of that scene towards the end of Friends where Chandler's cleaned the whole apartment but nothing's where it should be, and he's worried that Monica's going to come in and go mad at him, and so he just randomly shouts, "You can't come in here, Ross is naked." Also, the scene made me think of, because I presume this is the first time that Rhaenyra's had sex, and so like it made me think of that line in Lady Bird, where like she's where Saoirse Ronan is shouting at Timothy Chalamet, like, "I was on top. Who the fuck is on top their first time?" But yeah, it's really, really well done.
The princess was spied last evening beyond the walls of the keep, in a pleasure house.
What of it?
She was carrying on with her uncle. They were engaged in behaviors unbecoming of a maiden, of a princess.
What behaviors?
Well, must I say it, Your Grace?
You enter my bedchamber, accusing my daughter of something. Now speak it plainly.
Daemon and Rhaenyra were seen together in the bowels of a pleasure den.
In the morning, Otto Hightower meets with the small boy who recognised Rhaenyra the previous night. The small boy then meets with Missaria, who is tending to Daemon in an unknown area of the city. It's revealed that Missaria is no longer in the skin trade and now trades secrets and information. Otto relays the news of Rhaenyra and Daemon's night to Viserys, who angrily dismisses the news as a lie and tells Otto to get out. Alicent overhears their conversation and meets with Rhaenyra to ask her for the truth. Rhaenyra lies to Alicent and says that she and Daemon only went to see a show. Later that day, Daemon stumbles back through the walls of the Red Keep and is taken to meet Viserys. Viserys accuses Daemon of defiling Rhaenyra, an accusation that Daemon does not deny. In fact, he lies to the king that the accusations are true and asks Viserys for Rhaenyra's hand in marriage. In a rage, Viserys exiles Daemon for a second time. Afterwards, Alicent says that she believes Rhaenyra's version of events. Oh, poor Alicent. Lizzie, how are we on, I guess, the spy network at first?
Yeah, it's, is it good to see that they're back? it's kind of, I guess it's reassuring to know that nothing ever really changes in King's Landing, and the same old customs just live on for hundreds and hundreds of years, but... Yeah, I think I'm more noticed how Otto seems almost gleeful when delivering the news to Viserys. Like, he's been proven right all along by his own twisted version of the truth. And, like, Viserys' reaction is more kind of, like, sort of angry that he knows Otto is right, even though he's not quite there. Mm. And, yeah... the spy network. I'm surprised to see Missaria again in the trade secrets world. Like, how did she get there? I'm guessing a lot's changed in this 2 years since the premiere.
Yeah, it's something that I wish we'd seen a bit more of, but I guess, you know, but I guess that's the... Unfortunately, that's a problem of the time jumps that we've been getting through. But, yeah, It makes me think about the first episode and, like, who maybe ratted out Daemon about the Air for a Day stuff and, you know, who reported back, and it just makes me think. But
maybe.
It's something that I think has caused a bit of confusion. I've seen quite a few people be a bit confused about this. I guess wonder what you two have made of it, but... A lot of people were confused, wondering whether Daemon, like, knows that happened. I saw some people wondering, like, was the implication supposed to be that Daemon, like, brought Rhaenyra out and then, like, used Missaria to sell the information back in order to make Rhaenyra less trustworthy in some way?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people are
quite confused about that. Whereas I wasn't sure whether I thought of that or whether I thought it's Missaria kind of acting on her own around Daemon. What do you guys think?
I think it's more the latter, because I think in order for it to be a scheme that Daemon's put together, that somebody will see him out with Rhaenyra, like, and then Missaria would get that information, and then that information would get back to Otto, and then Otto would... It just feels like there's too many parts. I do feel like it's more Missaria just happens to have heard about it. And so, because I think something that quite a few people have missed... is that the boy that goes to speak to Otto and the boy that sees Rhaenyra come out of the brothel is the same boy that hands the money to Missaria when she's... Because we're obviously distracted by Daemon being given this tea, this you know, like a seltzer in water kind of thing, cure his hangover. Like, it feels a little bit like we miss the boy, and I feel like it's a bit, you know, sleight of hand. You know, I think it's just sort of like a trick of the camera that they've played, where, like, you notice that there is a boy, but you're not really focused on him because Missaria's talking and Daemon's talking, and, like, it's interesting. The show has built a network of spies again. So, good for that. Daemon coming back to the Red Keep and the throne room and stuff. Don't know what notes you've taken, Lizzie, about that scene.
I haven't really got anything, but again, I think, like you said before, it's impossible to know what Daemon's long game is.
Yeah.
Is he just kind of like a little finger, chaos is a ladder kind of thing, or is there something else going on?
The note I took was that I love the fact that Daemon gets dragged in and the whole time he's looking at the Iron Throne until the camera gets, you know, until we get him plonked on the floor. And Viserys isn't ever on the Iron Throne. It's like you keep expecting to see him, and it's like, okay, he's being dragged to see the king, have an audience with the king, have Viserys sit on the throne, and then have Daemon thrown at his feet or whatever. But like, it makes Viserys feel like he's actually in control of Daemon when he enters from the side unexpectedly. It's kind of like, oh, he's come from the side all of a sudden, and it's like, this isn't where we expected him to come in, and it immediately puts Viserys in control of the scene. Even if he's not in control of the events, he is at least in that specific moment when he's kicking Daemon about the floor while Daemon's like, I'm hungover, leave me alone. And like, Viserys is like, you did this. And I think the way Viserys tries to keep it all in-house, because he knows Otto's telling the truth, but he'll never tell Otto that he knows Otto's telling the truth. And yet, he's saying to Otto, like, it's a lie, it's ridiculous, I'll take out this person's eyes, I'll do this, it's a vile accusation and all that. You know, it's even like Rhaenyra lies about it too. And it's like a thing that Rhaenyra, Daemon, and Viserys all know about. And so whenever Daemon is in front of Viserys after the night on the town, if we will, it's just, he lets it all loose. And it feels like Viserys is kind of punishing himself for having a slightly forgiving nature with Daemon. I don't know about you, Jay, if you took anything about the Iron Throne, the throne room scene.
Yeah, to me it was him not being on the throne during it said that this isn't... It made it more personal. It made it like a personal anger. It felt like it was specifically that way to make it a brother versus brother argument, but rather than like a king, you know, meeting out, you know, judgment and justice or anything. It was like, if we keep him on the ground, making him actually make physical contact, he's not hiding behind his Kingsguard, he's personally upset and, you know, at his breaking point. That's how I saw that. Yeah. And it comes straight after the Otto one, where he's you know, it's almost at his breaking point with Otto. Well, I guess he is, isn't he? And yeah, I think it's just the, you know, we've seen him physically deteriorate. Like, he is literally rotting, and now we're kind of seeing him lose his relationships. The people around him are falling away, which is obviously sad to see. But at the same time, you're kind of like, you're not really sure. I do think, actually, there is like a little glimmer of goodness in him in the previous scene when Otto comes in and is like, Your Grace, your daughter was in a brothel, and he goes, yeah, and like, okay, it's like, what has she done that's actually like awful, which made me laugh. But yeah, we're just kind of seeing that character kind of fall apart, which is sad. But it's all kind of you understand the reasoning behind it, and it's kind of what, you know, what's the fallout from this going to be? And I completely agree. Again, it's the reiteration of what is Daemon's plan. I don't necessarily know if he actually has feelings for Rhaenyra. Like, it seems that there are bits that hint towards that. Obviously, you think of the bit in the first episode that hinted at that. It's all kind of a bit ambiguous and strange, but interesting for that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And also, during this little period of the episode, we also have Otto dealing with the information that's been given to him. I'm really curious in this episode about the moments that we spend alone with Otto, because quite often when we've seen him, it's been in company, whether it's with Viserys or Alicent or his older brother.
Yeah.
So we've had trouble working out his actual feelings on things. But there are moments in this episode where we get to just spend time with him before he goes in and tells Viserys about this rumour. And like, you can see that it pains him a little bit, or at least makes him nervous that he has to impart some pretty difficult information to Viserys. And I think in his own kind of twisted way, he does kind of care for Viserys, and he does care about his role. Like, even if he's a slithery eel, as I've described him in the past. And it's like, I don't know if it's a personal thing or a power thing for Otto, but I do think Otto is affected by the eventual decision. Mm-hmm. It does feel like it actually wounds him personally. Like, you know, it's not like, oh well, you know,
yeah,
we tried
definitely.
To, you know,
I think I've,
yeah.
I've seen a lot of people say that they felt sorry for him in that scene.
Yeah, it does make him sympathetic,
personally, but I think it is presenting him as somewhat sympathetic, definitely. Yeah. You are supposed to feel that.
Yeah, I think it does kind of wound him in a little way. I don't know, Lizzie, I guess, you know, I always kind of come to you as a decent, like, barometer because you're, like, you know, you're a proper, like, first-time watcher. You know, you've, like, not read the books and stuff, and so I think experiencing this story entirely as a TV show, I'm interested in your reading of, like, the moment when he does, I guess we're kind of skipping ahead a little bit here, but when he does get sacked.
Oh, we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like, I think it's more like, I don't know if it's sadness so much as shock. I don't think he really expected Viserys to stand up for himself and do that. I think it's just like, well, I've been here for so long, and also my daughter is your wife, so there's no way you're going to actually do this. And I think it is just it's more like surprise than genuine sadness. So cool. I don't feel sorry for him a jot, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, he is a, like I say, he's still Littlefinger if he had a daughter. And
yeah.
Oh, definitely.
The truth does not matter, Rhaenyra. Only perception. You have exposed yourself. Now we must both suffer the consequences.
Were I born a man, I could bear Tymer if I wanted. I could father a dozen bastards, and no one in your court would blink an eye.
You're right. But you were born a woman.
So you will strip me of my titles and name Aegon in my stead?
I would. But it is mine to hold the realm together, not sow it with further division. Your courtship is at an end. You will wed Selaenor Velaryon, and you will do so without protest.
The son of the sea snake, so I can be a remedy for your political headaches.
You are my political headache.
In the last part of the episode, later that night, Rhaenyra is summoned to see Viserys. He tells her that her courtship is at an end, and that she will marry Laenor Velaryon without protest. Rhaenyra agrees to do this on the condition that Otto Hightower is removed from his position as Hand of the King. The next evening, Rhaenyra is alone in her chambers when Grand Maester Melos arrives with moon tea, which has been specially brewed to remove any unfortunate consequences. Guess we've kind of talked a little bit already about Otto and whatnot, so we can skip ahead a little bit. But I kind of like that the episode is bookended by... It's bookended really nicely because the episode starts with Rhaenyra rejecting loads of suitors and Daemon returning to King's Landing. And then it ends with Rhaenyra having a suitor forced on her while Daemon is exiled again.
Yeah.
It's a pretty... it means that a lot happens in between times. And again, these moments are not like earth-shattering big changes like Game of Thrones like to do. They're much smaller. They affect people rather than areas, and they affect, you know, families rather than wars and such. I mean, obviously things will ramp up, and I think House of the Dragon will become more of a moments show as it carries on. But Benioff and Weiss were very good at executing shock, and they were good at executing twists, I think. And this show hasn't really gone for shock or twists yet. It just goes for developments. Just maybe the scene with the dagger is the one thing against the episode that I have. And I'm just kind of bored of seeing it now. Like, I think they just need to let it drift out of the show after season one, because I think if I was only consuming the episode, it would be fine. But I think it's just every morning after every episode, I come onto social media and it's like, it's just people arguing about whether, oh, this scene with the dagger means that the end of Game of Thrones isn't canon anymore. And then there's people going, oh, it means that it is canon. And like Bran saw the prophecy and he gave it to Arya, and so I just don't care. Why did they do it?
When it happened in episode one, I said, like, ugh, I mean, if you're gonna put it in, if you're gonna make that link, cool, you do it immediately, get it over and done with, tell everyone, yeah, this is connected to Game of Thrones, there's, you know, a lineage, it's a whole big thing, that's fine, and then just move on. don't know why they had to come back to it. Like, four episodes in and we're just kind of reiterating it almost. Mm. Like, it seems that's the only, as you said, but like, the only thing that kind of worries me, because I'm like, if you've brought it back once, are you going somewhere with this thread? Because I really hope you're not. I hope we just have a nice separate, this is this section of this story with all these new characters. But if you're going to keep on bringing up the other story, tangentially, but still, yeah, it worries me a little bit.
I get the feeling that in future, it's going to be like a thing. It's going to be like a prop that Rhaenyra looks at every now and again and is like, you know, no, it must be me. You know, like that sort of thing, like she'll be, you know, sat miserable in her bedroom every now and again. It's like, oh, campaign for the throne's not going very well or something like that. And then in a moment of doubt, she'll look at the dagger and go, no, it's the prophecy. I must go back and fight. Or so. And it just, maybe I'll be fine if that was just it. Like, you know, she just looks at it on a table and the camera does that thing where, like, it shifts the focus without actually moving. Where, like, they'll just move the lens so that it focuses on the dagger on the table. Like, and then Rhaenyra goes blurry and the dagger comes into clarity. And then they move back again to see, then Rhaenyra comes clear and the dagger goes blurry. If they don't go any further than that, I will be completely fine with it. I know that it plays a bigger role this season because it's been in trailers and stuff, and it gets involved in scenes with the older versions of Rhaenyra and Alicent that obviously we've not met in the show yet. But yeah. I don't know if you have any more notes about this bit of the episode. I guess like the abortion tea is something to discuss, but
I mean, I guess it's just, I joked earlier about the whole Viserys, like, it's like, who cares if she was in a brothel, whatever. Like, I joked about that, but, like, this is another one of those things of, like, yeah, we're seeing Viserys be stripped away of all these different things and him becoming a more, like, angry and bitter person. But this, like, he still loves his daughter, and he also kind of loves her in a soft way. He's not, he you know, he asked her, you know, what happened, and then he kind of afterwards is like, okay, but just in case you're lying, here's an out. And it's like, this is your downfall as a character. You are too soft on the people that you love. And while it might be good for her, that's going to be a benefit.
Hmm.
That's how I took it.
Lizzie, how about you? Have you got any remaining notes that you'd just like to voice?
I think partially that, but also it suggests, again, cowardice. Because it's not like you're offering that to her yourself. It's you're getting someone else to do that. And not even being blunt about what it does or what it symbolises.
Yeah, he's kind of like when Otto is trying to kind of sugarcoat the information that he's handing over. Viserys is like, you know, could you dumb it down a shade? You know, that sort of thing. And like he's kind of getting to speak plainly. And then when he sends the maester to Rhaenyra, and it's like the maester, you know, we mustn't say words in front of the princess, you know, and we must, especially not because she's so young, and we mustn't sully her mind with unpleasant thoughts. It's just a tea that removes any unwanted consequences. Yes, that's what we'll say. And she'll drink it and it'll all be fine and we'll never have to speak of it again and that sort of thing. And yeah, it feels a little bit like how, I don't know, how Tony Soprano would talk to Meadow about these sorts of things. Trying to not talk about it in a womanly way. It's one of those conversations where Tony turned to Carmella and be like, oh, you go upstairs, you do it, you deal with it. But yeah, I guess that brings us to a close. So, Lizzie, I want your line of the episode.
I'm going to go with, you Targaryens do have queer customs. From Alicent.
Yes. Who is your loser this week?
My loser of the week is Daemon. I don't know if anybody's gone from loser to winner to loser in the span of four episodes, but it feels like the natural choice this week.
Okay, yep. I don't think many people listening are going to disagree there. But it's a sign of the kind of characters that this show has. Who is your
That's
winner?
Very true.
Who is your winner?
My winner of the week is Rhaenyra.
Okay, yep. How come?
Well, I mean, I'm surprised this is the first time I'm nominating her, but I think in generally in this episode, obviously, I loved the nightlife scenes, but I think the way she took control with Sir Criston and just owned that situation and also stood up for herself against her father and kind of worked to restore her bond with Alicent, yeah, I think it's all cause for celebration.
I saw a tweet, actually, that it was what's-her-face from Buttercup from Powerpuff Girls, comfortably asleep in bed. And the caption was, how Rhaenyra sleeps after making out with her uncle, having sex with Sir Criston Cole, and then lying to Alicent, and then getting Otto removed as Hand of the King, and just all comfortable and tucked up in bed and stuff like that. Yeah, she played the game properly this week, and
absolutely,
she got a lot out of it. So next week, we'll be back for season 1, episode 5, which is entitled "We Light the Way," and yeah, we'll see you for then. I think there's a wedding next week. We all know how they go in this world.
Oh,
so yeah. We'll see you for it.